This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Good morning. Welcome to Classic Business Breakfast with myself, Nastasia Aronsa. It's 5 minutes after seven, and I'm not alone every day. I handle this ship with my co-pilot.
Tash, did you just add a minute to all of life? It's 4 minutes past 7 o'clock this morning.
Okay, it's 4 minutes past seven.
Yeah, good morning to you. It is a wonderful Monday. A bit of rain here, there, in some spots of Joburg as well, but it is a fresh one, and we really have a jam-packed show for you this morning on Classic Business Breakfast.
Right, we've got two ministers. I feel like every day we do the show, we set the bar higher and higher and higher.
Yep.
And this particular case, we've got Tourism Minister Derek Hanekom talking to us about the end of the child visa rules that will help boost tourism. And then we also have Minister Lindiwe Zulu from Small Business Development, and she's going to be talking about how small businesses will receive more support from government.
Yeah, quite a difficult portfolio she's had really since its inception. Just how well can she handle the budget constraints that she has? She's barely gotten enough money to get everything off the ground, and of course she's supposed to lead some of the NDP targets as well, so quite difficult on her part. Also then, right of reply is what we're giving the JSE as well this morning. The CEO of the JSE, Ms. Nikki Newton-King, will join us on the line as well. Signia called out the JSE on dubious listings. How big an issue is it? And should they really take responsibility for some of that? We'll get into that discussion a little bit later. But let's start your Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb this Monday morning.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
These market indicators are brought to you by FNB, bringing you the 48-hour cash accelerator. Visit fnb.co.za for more info. Looking at international markets, Asian markets advanced as investors digest the weekend US-China trade developments. Japan's Nikkei edged up 0.3%, Hong Kong's Hang Seng advancing 1.04%, and the Shanghai Composite up 0.4%. US markets on Friday, S&P 500 and the NASDAQ fell 0.3% and 0.4% respectively, while the Dow Jones closed above the flat line. And over in Europe, FTSE 100 down 0.1%. These market indicators were brought to you by FNB. Get a great rate and quick access to your investment. T's and C's apply.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Time to check in on how the local markets will perhaps perform today, how the international markets have also done fairly as well. Graham Kerner from Kerner Perspective joining us in studio. Graham, thank you so much for the time. It's been an interesting time on the JSE, I think, across the whole year. But thus far, JSE slumping just a little bit as well towards the end of last week. The Rand as well seeing a bit of headwinds. Is that much the same today, do you think?
Yeah, good morning, Arabile. I think the prospects for the South African market will probably be a continuation of what we saw on Friday in terms of the Rand hedges doing a little bit better. Obviously, some company-specific stuff in terms of the giants. You had, you know, Richemont out with results. Mm-hmm. But I think, as Nastasia was saying, Asian markets are looking better this morning. I think that's because some of this tension that has been building around trade wars between Trump and Xi Jinping seems to at least be moderating slightly. So I think that's what's giving those markets a lift. So on balance of arguments, I think we'll have a better day. Let's not forget, almost 20% of this market is made up of Naspers. Sure. Tencent is up 1.2% in Hong Kong this morning. So the outlook is for probably a stronger open.
Yeah, but you speak about the geo tensions. That prospect could be very volatile. It could change at any moment, couldn't it?
Absolutely right. And I think that's the thing that the world is really battling with. And to me, it's almost like a recalibration that is necessary. Mm. Because if you think about it, from the global financial crisis, we had a very loose monetary policy in terms of quantitative easing, effectively zero negative interest rates in some economies. That all seems to be turning, even in the UK, growing pressure on the BOE governor to start tightening, as he's promised to do. And I think we're looking for more direction later this week, some of the minutes from the Fed, in terms of their interpretation of where they feel inflation's going. And that, yeah, that'll probably then, you know, almost take the penciling in of three rate hikes in the US later in this year. to, you know, them being inked in and questions, maybe even what the outlook is for 2019. So I think exactly right. There's a lot more angst around. And then on top of that, you've got the geopolitics. Sure. And, you know, something that I can't get away from is the fact that in the first 6 months, America managed to rack up a budget deficit of $600 billion. Now, sure, you know, you can sort of almost poo-poo that and say, well, that's not relevant because, you know, you're going to get this hockey stick pickup in GDP. I don't buy it. I think the U.S. debt situation is becoming quite serious, and I think it might be one of those things that's pushed the tenure in the U.S. to over 3%. And a lot of people are saying, well, what was the catalyst? Was it inflation? But I think it's just a combination of things. So people getting a little bit anxious. And, of course, now suddenly you're earning better on the three-year than you are in dividend yield in the S&P. It just changes the dynamic. So a lot of recalibration necessary. And it just, in our mind, forces you to go back to the fundamentals.
But should they be worried at the fact that, the tenure has sort of gone to that 3% level? At the same time, how then do you recalibrate in this time? Do you, is it mostly for value, or are you doing it just short term? Because things could still also alter themselves now.
It's such a wonderful question. That's why I talk about recalibration. This concept of recalibration is not new in our mind. We've been saying for a long time, the problem is the fact that the world became used to 10 years at 1.3,
sure,
virtually no interest rate in terms of the repo rates or the Fed fund rate. So that was the problem. The real issue for us, though, Arabile, is not in the fact, well, what's the impact going to be on the global economy? Mm. In large part, loose monetary policy had the effect of inflating asset prices.
Yes.
Didn't really have a massive impact on the underlying economy. So they say Wall Street benefited, Main Street less so. And I think you might find the inverse of that. But, I mean, Jamie Dimon has gone on record as saying, you know, brace yourself, 4% on the 10-year could be a reality. And sure, I would agree with that. So it's simply because we're suffering from, it's not so recency bias, you know, 10 years of ridiculously low interest rates. You know, our starting point, our reference point was all wrong.
Yeah. What about the impact then of Cyril Ramaphosa in all of this? Perhaps market sentiment as well. Is that continuing, or is that beginning to peter off just a little bit?
I think
as well?
It's getting, you know, the Ramaphosa effect is starting to wear a little bit thin.
Yeah.
Although I do think that South Africa has a hell of a lot more going for it in terms of the emerging market cluster, because let's be honest, we were running the race with a lame leg over the last 10 years, and a little bit of good news will go a long way. So I think on balance of arguments, the rand that's gone from, let's say, 1160 to 1270, it's partly the South Africa story, but I think more importantly, it's the fact that the dollar has been, you know, relatively strong in the last little while. And I think generally there's an angst around, you know, there's the old saying that, you know, when the US catches cold, everybody else gets flu.
Indeed.
So I think that's the thing we're grappling with. But I do think that local economy stocks, if you look at the retailers and the banks, they were pushed a little bit beyond fair value.
Sure.
And that's part of that recalibration that's happening. And it's healthy and it's natural.
Very quickly, you did speak about the rand at around 1270. It's 1277 for now. How soon do we get to 13? And does it keep deteriorating from here on?
Look, I mean, I'm not a technical analyst. So I don't put magical, you know, properties on key levels. But I think the reality of it is that there's global angst, and that would probably result in a reversion to sort of safe assets.
Yeah,
although I would question the logic of the US bonds as safe assets. But I think for the foreseeable future, the rand can carry on weakening along with the emerging market cluster. But at a point in time, South African bonds at 8.5 or whatever will start being appealing, and I think you'll see a stabilization.
Graham, hopefully you can just stay with us just a little bit longer as well. We'll get into some other discussions. But we are joined now by Nikki Newton-King, Tash.
Yeah, we are. That's because on Friday, you may have heard this interview, Cigna CEO Marta Vaziska accused the JSE of ignoring its duties to investors by giving a green light to some questionable listings. And Nikki Newton-King, the CEO of the JSE, joins us on the line to clear out some of the accusations. Nikki, thank you so much for your time this morning. So my then first question is Marta right? Are you ignoring your duties to investors? And she's raised some, you know, dubious listings, Sagamata being one of them, which was canned at the last minute, Resilient, which, you know, had some issues around whether they, I don't know, were manipulating their share price artificially. What do you say when it comes to Marta's accusations?
Well, everybody's entitled to opinion, but the facts don't support that particular opinion. The first thing is, like every exchange in the world, we set listings requirements, and every single company that is listed on the JSE must meet those listings requirements. Those listings requirements are different for different types of companies. So smaller companies will meet different hurdles to very big companies, mining companies, different things to special purpose acquisition, cash vehicles, and the like. But we set rules. And once those rules are set, then we apply them equitably for everyone, irrespective of whether we have a particular view about the people behind the listing. You have to, if you meet the requirements, we are required to list you. We don't have a discretion. The second thing, just like every company, every exchange in the world, we require certain information to be disclosed by issuers. Why do we do that? Because we want information to be available out there for investors to make their own opinion on the value of a company. So we require certain information to be certified by professionals. For instance, accounts, valuations of companies have to, valuation of property companies have to be certified by certified property valuers. Accounts have to be signed off by auditors. In respect of mining companies, specialists have to sign off on what's on the resources available. But so we require certain information out there to be put out there by issuers on a regular basis, and in many cases that information is certified by independent professionals. Hmm. But once that information is out there, and this is true of every single exchange in the world, investors must make their own mind up on the valuation of a company. And you'll know this, that even in respect of companies whose names you are not currently talking about, there will be analysts with different views about the valuations of companies. Same facts, different views. So our role as an exchange is not to take a view as to whether or not we like or don't like a particular investor or a particular promoter of a company, or a view on whether or not we agree with the valuation. Our role is to make sure that there is sufficient information out there so investors can make up their own minds.
Mrs. Newton-King, Marta Vizdiska from Cigna then explicitly says that the valuation of certain companies bears no semblance to the real value of underlying assets. Do you believe that you should be at the forefront of determining the real value of those underlying assets in order to make sort of a fair assumption in changing perhaps or revisiting your policies on listings?
I don't think it's an exchange's role at all to determine the value of a company. In fact, you can see on every single company on the exchange, that value is determined in the eyes of the buyers and the sellers, and the exchange is a facilitator of the flow of capital between them. But so it's not our role to do that, and I don't know any exchange who certifies that a given value is correct. But what I would say is that it is important that we make sure that there is sufficient information out there, and so that people can, in fact, have different views about whether or not they want to invest in the company. No one is obliged to invest in a company. Certainly the ones that have been recently talked about, no one's obliged to invest in them. So the very fact that we get information out there provides investors with a view, with an ability to determine their own view. And I think perhaps this question of whether or not the valuation was a fair valuation, you should ask of the investors who were about to make big investments in those companies. But that said, I do think that there is a moment for us to pause in this country, and particularly in corporate South Africa, about whether or not the noise around corporate behavior, etc., is shaking people's confidence in the market and in corporate behavior generally. And certainly from the exchange's perspective, we are looking at whether or not there is more guidance we can give, perhaps even more rules, although it's not clear that rules per se will help, to help get investors feeling more confident with what's going on.
Nikki, on that note, then, you know, and you touched on it now, following the wave of corporate scandals we've seen, how do you then strike a balance between creating more rules and also, you know, allowing things, people to disclose because they're honest? Because you can have as many rules as you like, but if the companies themselves are also doing dodgy behavior behind the scenes that you may not be aware of and other people may not be aware of, how do we strike that balance in order to ensure confidence?
This is an absolutely critical point, and I think that this brings to the responsibility that what I call the guardians of governance has, the people who hold managers and executives accountable. And they all the way from the boards of directors to the big asset owners to the trustees of the pension funds to the media, as an example, people have to ask the hard questions. And then, so that's the one point. The other point is to really have businesses figure out that we all have a social license to operate, something beyond just the right to make money with a legal license. And how do we cut that properly? What's the right way for us to think about how we share the upside of doing business with all of our stakeholders? And I think there's work for us to do there.
Before I let you go, I understand, and I remember reading this earlier on, that you're working on tighter rules for companies with listed debt instruments. How far are you getting with regards to putting that together?
Very far, thank you, very far. It is important that companies with debt instruments have somewhat the same levels of disclosure as corporate. So certainly corporate issuers of debt do have the same levels of disclosure for most of their debt instruments as they do for their equity instruments. The real place to look at is in state-owned enterprises, and there we have put out requirements for publication, and I hope we will very soon be in a position to implement them. But the way that it works is that you have to put out your requirements for public consultation, and we'll take those consultation feedback into account before finalizing them.
All right, that's Nikki Newton-King, who's the CEO of the JSE. Time to check in on traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
22 minutes after 7 o'clock, we're hoping to still get the Minister of Small Business Development, Lindi Wezulu. We are struggling to get through on her line, but and hopefully we can get to chat to her in just a bit. But Graham Kerner from Kerner Invest Perspective still joining us in studio as well. Graham, you've heard from Nikki Newton-King. I'm sure you've heard parts of Magda's argument as well. Your thoughts just with regards to that back and forth. Should the JSE be held liable in any way? Should they take responsibility in many ways?
Well, I think the whole ecosystem, auditors, you know, the audit committee, the board of directors, ratings agencies, all of us have a role to play. Mm. So I share Magda's frustration, but at the same time, I think that it points to the fact that the ecosystem has failed rather than the regulator. Mm. But what I do think is quite important, and I do think when the dust finally settles and the facts start coming out in Steinhoff, we need to say, okay, how do we safeguard against this again? And it's impossible until we've got the information to create a blueprint to prevent it. So I think the key thing for me, though, I think what Magda is saying is, but the JSE, you construct you create the environment for these companies to be listed. You create the indices which force us to invest in it. And it's one of my sort of hobby horses, is just the way indices are constructed in this country. And, you know, until recently, you know, Naspers represented 23% of the top 40 index as the share price came down. So what you're eventually sitting with is a situation where two shares represented 30% of the market. The top five represented circa 50% of the market. You know, things like Resilient and Fortress, you know, managed to come into the index. And then it's a case, to me, something like the top 40 is—it's almost like you're watering the weeds and you're cutting the flowers, so to speak, because it's last year's hero that makes its way into that. So I think what Magda and her industry should be debating is, okay, well, if we don't trust the sanctity of the system, how do we allocate capital? Do we use the JSE's indices, or do we start creating our own indices? But I personally feel very strongly that it's not for the JSE to say what valuation is right and wrong. It's my job as an asset manager to allocate capital to businesses that we think have merit and based on my own valuation metrics.
Yeah. Other news as well, making a bit of headlines today as well. Finance Minister said to revisit the probe into the PIC. Of course, there were allegations of corruption against the CEO of the Public Investment Corporation, Dan Majela. A letter then from Finance Minister Nhlanhla Nene also indicating that he wants to look into those allegations. Yeah. It dates right back or sort of feeds right back into the issue that we keep having with management issues, with the state of how assured are you in your management ensuring that a company can move forward. This is just just a tip of just what is happening across the board by the seams of things?
Look, I mean, the PIC plays such an important role in society as the manager of you know, trillions of rands worth of employee pensions. Also, you know, obviously, when you're that big, you're forced to invest in a whole lot of things. Mm-hmm. But they had quite big exposure to Steinhoff. So I think it's part of a process, really, in my mind. It's the same as the cleansing at SAA or, you know, questions at Transnet. It's part of the process of saying, you know, we have to be sure that the people who've got these critical roles in state-owned enterprises are acting in the best interest of the country.
I'd actually be curious to know whether the PIC has the discretion to say, you know what, we're not interested in investing in a company like this, even if it's been, you know, going through 3 years of successful profit and it meets the JSE's requirements and it's great, yeah, but this is not where we see ourselves putting money into. It would be great to get the PIC to, you know, come onto the show and tell us, you know, how exactly they assess whether they're going to be on board a certain investment or not.
Yeah. And also, I think the critically important is the role of other assets. So, you know, I personally believe, you know, a bigger, stronger public-private partnership environment is what one of the things that would set South Africa free. So I think, you know, investments like that, I think also what could be very constructive is if the PIC has a defined capital pot for venture capital, private equity, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. So I think it's all just part of a healthy process, and it's part of this new dispensation that we have in South Africa. So I think it would be very useful to have a conversation with the PIC and how do they actually allocate capital across, you know, in terms of offering bailouts to SAA or Eskom and the role that they see themselves playing, A, as a manager of assets, but B, also in almost being the lender of last resort to government and state-owned enterprises.
Marion Roberts and Avinge had heavily being announced on Friday, but then a major shareholder, of course, Aton, saying, you know, they're not going to support that bid. How successful do we see that happening, that merger?
Well, look, I mean, if you've got a shareholder that's got enough to block it from a corporate action point, sure, of view, then clearly that deal is probably dead in the water. Having said that, though, I think it's always interesting that, you know, the Marion Roberts board obviously has a specific view. Mm. I think the Avenge board may be saying, well, and I think it's probably right, together we're stronger. You know, we can probably eliminate some duplications and become more efficient as an organization. But at the same time, Atom's built up a position. They put risk capital to work and they see an opportunity there. And it's their, you know, right as capitalists to reject that. But I would really like to see is that the Murrays and Avenge teams actually spell out the collective interest for minority shareholders, yeah, and try and get Atom on side, because if it is a good deal for them, then long term it'll be good for Atom as well.
Yeah. How long does it continue for, though? I mean, is it a deal that we see happening, if it does happen at all? As you said, it is perhaps dead in the water considering Atom's view, but If they were to try and convince them in any possible way, it could take a very, very long time.
Well, the reality of it is you've had Atom making an offer. Obviously, management or the board, independent board, saying they don't agree with the valuation. So I think it's almost the ball, I would say, is in the management's court, in Murray Management's court, to actually convince Atom that this is a deal that is in their interest. And that maybe what they end up with is a bigger investment in aggregate terms, but maybe a smaller investment in the combined entity. But they've got to convince Atom, I believe, of the merits of it. Otherwise, it's not going anywhere in a hurry, I don't think.
Yeah.
Right. Let's look at news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
It's 31 minutes after 7, and I'm joined on the line by Minister Derek Hanekom. He's the Minister of Tourism. We are obviously still trying to get a hold of the Minister of Small Business Development, Lindiwe Zulu, to talk about the support she's getting from government in order to propel small businesses. But right now we're going to have a look at the headway that Minister Derek Hanekom is making in easing the visa regulations, including those on traveling with children. They had a damaging impact on the tourism sector, which accounts accounts for almost a tenth of the economy. And to talk to us about what he is doing is the minister. Minister, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having us on the show.
So I know that you're working together with the current Home Affairs Minister, Melusi Gigaba, in order to ease some of those tough visa regulations. But before we talk about the progress you're making, let's talk about the impact that it had on the tourism sector. I mean, from the stats that you've seen, what damage did we actually do?
You know, well, very significant, yes, especially in the first year of the introduction of these immigration regulations, as they were called. It's difficult to quantify exactly what its impact was because it was combined, unfortunately, with people changing their travel plans because of the Ebola threat. We didn't have Ebola in South Africa, but it was a factor. And that was in 2015. But there have been all sorts of studies and estimates, and it really amounts to billions lost as a result of people not coming to South Africa because of the visa difficulties they were experiencing.
Right.
Or let's say.
And the countries that were most affected, where we previously would see a major influx of tourists emanating from those countries?
Just repeat.
So the countries that were most affected, Europe or China, where previously, before the visa regulations kicked in, those were the countries we may have seen more tourists coming into South Africa.
Yes, very definitely. I mean, there are two components of it. One was the regulations impacting on family travel, and they really affected the countries that are not affected by other visa regulations. In other words, the non-visa requiring countries like the USA, Canada, UK and Europe, they don't need visas to come to South Africa, but there were really onerous requirements for single adults traveling with a child or children traveling on their own, even if they had consent from their parents, school groups traveling to South Africa. So they were affected by that component. But the visa requirements, which, you know, in 2015, it was tantamount to from having been able to do a postal visa application to having to apply in person, for example, in China. At the time, it meant going physically to Shanghai or Beijing in this massive geographical spread country. Mm. And it became very expensive to come to South Africa, very inconvenient. So it had tremendous impact on both China and India, and in fact, all visa-requiring countries. And we still see it, by the way. Not that we haven't eased. Yes, there has been progress. But very interesting to note now is that the countries not requiring visas in 2017 grew substantially. The numbers grew. Mm. The countries almost across the board, the countries requiring visas, by contrast, some of them declined, like China declined by 17%. New Zealand is very instructive, of course, because we could see the impact of a visa introduction. Until last year, there was no visa requirement for New Zealanders traveling to South Africa. After the introduction of a visa requirement, it dropped by 24%. By contrast, Russia, there was a visa requirement. In 2016, there was a waiver, no longer requiring visas.
Yeah.
Russia in 2017 went up by 52%, huge. So as soon as we took out that visa requirement, the numbers went up quite dramatically. As soon as we introduced a visa requirement in New Zealand, the numbers dropped quite disturbingly.
Right. So tell me about the discussions you're having with the Department of Home Affairs. How are they progressing in order to ease the situation?
Okay. Well, I think the minister, Minister Melusi Gigaba, really sees that tourism is a very important growth sector for the economy, very important to the economy because of its employment effects. And so, you know, he is trying to do whatever he can as minister to make it easier for people to come to South Africa. We had a first round of discussions, and it was very encouraging because they're doing a number of things, the Department of Home Affairs, to make it easier for people to travel to South Africa. I'll run through, if you don't mind, a couple of those things.
Sure.
Well, one is where, you know, it's a fairly simple change that is needed in terms of the regulations for family travel to South Africa. Now, you know, that's a case of it's either done or it isn't. But there's an agreement that we will, in fact, put into effect the cabinet decision of 2016, that instead of having a hard requirement that anybody that is categorized as a minor or an adult traveling with a minor or guardian would have to have a whole set of documents, that we would do the same with regard to that minor, those minors traveling, as is done in the USA, Canada, UK, and other countries. And that is that we would send out a very strong advisory note, or Home Affairs would, that they may be required to prove the relationship between adult and child, because we do want to be combating child trafficking and human trafficking more generally, but you don't want to do it at your own country's expense, if you like. So that's what the that's what's done in various countries. If there are any grounds for suspicion, then the traveler would be taken aside and say, and asked to demonstrate or prove the relationship between parent and child, single parent or child, or adult traveling with child. And, you know, so it's not about a matter of just being turned away. So that would be very, very good, very helpful. And we have an undertaking that that would be dealt with in the next few weeks, for that matter. When it comes to visas, people traveling to South Africa with visas, I mentioned the case of China. Now, China today is the biggest single outbound travel market or outbound tourism market. It's bigger than the USA. More Chinese today travel around the world, visit various countries, than US citizens. And so everybody's trying to get their share of what is a growing tourism market in China. In China, it's still difficult for people to get visas. So what is being worked on in the Department of Home Affairs, and if it is put into effect, it will make a huge difference. Firstly, they're saying in the course of this financial year, they will go they will move towards electronic visas, e-visas.
Yeah.
And so therefore people won't physically have to go, or even the travel agents won't have to physically collect passports, take them to the embassy or the consulate.
Sure.
But people could simply apply electronically, and then they would be issued visas upon arrival. Now that would make a huge difference to especially the Chinese market and the Indian market. By the way, both of them are in our top 10 source market countries.
Minister, all of that is bound to cost somewhat. How big is that costing for South Africa in the view of changing things around? And at the same time, how much do you think this would boost tourism in South Africa by?
Let's start in the second half. I mean, both countries that I mentioned, but of course all other visa requirements would be affected positively.
Sure.
Because it is, you know, enough research has been done, and I've mentioned the very specific examples to show that if you make it easier for people to travel to your country, especially, by the way, countries like South Africa, which are long-haul destinations.
Yes.
In China's case in particular, because it's already a big source market to us, and India for that matter, if we, instead of a decline, you know, if we can get 100,000 extra tourists from China, if we can double it in the next couple of years, and potentially we could, I can't right now on the air translate that into numbers, but it's not that difficult to do.
Yeah.
So the economic impact of making it easier for people to travel to South Africa is huge. What would it cost the Department of Home Affairs? Well, that's a figure that they would have to give you.
Indeed,
but
okay.
I'm quite convinced that ultimately it will reduce in cost reduction.
Yeah.
Because right now they need staff, they need people all over the world to process visa applications.
All right.
It would effectively mean centralizing visa applications. They would need additional staff and additionally trained staff to deal with it upon arrival. But I think the ultimate cost would be less than the cost incurred at the moment.
Minister, thank you so much for your time. That's where we're going to have to leave it. Minister of Tourism, Derek Hanekom there. Child visa rules being changed and perhaps to aid the economy of South Africa. It's 19 minutes to 8 o'clock. Let's get into your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
It's a new cryptocurrency ATM in South Africa being launched as well this week. The South African cryptocurrency technology company Vendibit revealing a new and improved version of their cryptocurrency ATM. On the line, Daniel Capiello, who is the Vendibit senior blockchain consultant. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. It's not the first. You initially did launch back in 2014. Perhaps not so well received at the time. I don't think the boom in Bitcoin or the like was expected at that point in time. But for now, how do you see this one faring?
Good morning, sir, and thank you for having us. It's a very exciting time here at Vendibit as we're bringing, a relaunch of the first African so-called Bitcoin ATM, as we call a VTM. Hardware and software have been upgraded since 2014.
Sure.
We perhaps were a bit early in the market several years ago, but certainly things have changed and the public awareness has increased about cryptocurrencies. And our goal at Vendibit is bring high tech down to earth.
Yeah,
this machine is humanizing and democratizing access to this new phenomenon called cryptocurrencies.
Are you worried at all about regulation, which still hasn't perhaps caught up with the technology itself?
Well, certainly we don't exist in a bubble, and we're very aware that there is regulation and it is also evolving. We look forward to working together with the regulators and are very blessed to have on board our team some of the brightest minds in South Africa, both in software and hardware and banking, and we look forward to the challenge to work together with all of the relevant parties.
Yeah. Just last month, the South African Revenue Services did give some sort of clarity on just how cryptocurrencies will be treated as far as tax is concerned in South Africa. Are you looking to change that in any way? Because for now, cryptocurrencies are not considered a currency. They're still going to be treated as an asset.
Well, certainly the how cryptocurrencies are received and regulated and taxed is evolving. It's the old story of the blind man and the elephant, where each one is trying to feel a different part of the animal to find out what it is. And around the world, there's not a clear consensus if it's an asset or a currency, or we're looking at nothing less than an evolution and revolution in how we perceive money and data. So certainly it will continue to evolve. We look forward to adapting to the market, but we believe it's also important to focus on the five C's. The customers coming first, and compliance, certainly, and the convenience of using a Vendibit VTM and with a small amount of cash and learning a bit more about cryptocurrency.
Yeah,
these five C's will allow the individual to onboard. Certainly there's a unequal distribution of these type of machines around the world, mostly concentrated in North America, USA, Canada, Europe, Asia, where they're becoming more normal. You can pay your taxes in Switzerland in cryptocurrency.
Sure.
You certainly have some of the largest financial companies in the world, like Goldman Sachs, getting involved. So obviously the big boys are coming to town.
Some buy-in then, certainly, certainly some buy-in coming in through there. Thank you so much for the time. That's where we're going to have to leave it, unfortunately, Daniel. Daniel Capiello is Vendibit Senior Blockchain Consultant. Their first Vendibit Blockchain VTM, as they like to call it, opens as well in South Africa. It is an update of their 2014 version.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
So about 12 minutes to the top of the hour. An interesting topic, and I think probably the past couple of weeks, all we've been talking about is land, which is a very key and topic to look at. But Wandile Sehlobo, who is an agricultural economist, attended NAMPO, which took place in Boerterville, and a whole host of topics came up, looking at whether youth, the young people are participating in the agricultural sector. And but one key topic that stood out for me is whether size matters in South African farming. And to talk to us about that is Wandile Sehlobo. Wandile, thank you so much for your time. I mean, when you look at South Africa as I mean, the economy is a dualistic economy. I mean, we've got both the formal and the informal side of things. But when you look at that context, is there room for both small and big farms in our economy?
No, thanks for having me on. Definitely, I think there's a room for both of them, mainly because, as you rightly say, being on a dualistic nature of our economy, there are certain pockets of the country where big corporates or big agribusinesses can't really serve efficiently, mainly because maybe their business models can't really fit in well there. It doesn't make economic sense and some stuff. So you find that there would be local, relatively small farmers that will serve those areas. But I think for me, the discussion should largely really be on saying, okay, we do accept that we can have both of those sort of farmers, but how do we increase productivity and making sure that even those guys, while they are small, at least on a yield perspective, they can do just as well as what we see on the corporate sector. And I think that's where much of the investments and the focus should really be on.
Where does one find stats that look at the size of South African farms? Because I understand that the sizes have changed over time. And what were the factors, if you can share, that have accounted for that change over the past few years or since the data was collated probably in the early 1900s?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're starting back from 1900 in South Africa. Obviously, as you continue over the years, the farms were relatively small. I'd say majority of them were less, roughly around about 60% of them were around about, in sizes, 800 hectares per farm on average, if you're looking roughly across the country. And obviously, that was largely because of the government support and stuff, because if you were working on a relatively small farm, in most cases, you can be globally competitive to some extent, depending on what you are producing. And we know then how South Africa operated over that period. There was a bit of government, a lot of government support through subsidies, cheap labor and stuff that sustained the agricultural industry. But you fast forward and you go to 1997, 1998, when the agricultural markets were deregulated. Right in that period, obviously, we saw that's when farms started getting bigger, because now everyone was exposed in a global market, and really the guys that couldn't really stand tall in that competition, they had to fall off. There was a bit of consolidation and stuff, and that's when we saw farms really getting bigger. And I mean, the latest statistics of 2011 or so, the average farm in South Africa was around about 2,000 hectares. So there's been that shift in there, and those are the guys that serve us well when we're looking at the national food security, looking at exporting. But obviously, there is that room in those pockets, which you mentioned earlier, to say in the deep rural areas, for example, you're looking at the Eastern Cape, somewhere Flagstaff, Bizana, all of those areas, you could still have the small farmers, but they just need to be efficient. And that can be done by either putting on new technologies as well as improving the infrastructure in those areas.
Right. Before I let you go, is there a relationship between farm size, government support, and GDP?
Yes. Because, I mean, look, the more that the government gets in to support the farmers, the more people sit back because they're getting a bit of support and stuff, which is what we saw in South Africa. Obviously, when you look at the U.S. and somewhere, the nature could be relatively different. But the idea is to make sure that the government support is as limited as possible so that people can be efficient. Consolidation will happen as long as the competition is tight, and the new technologies that come up, they support that. So we will continue to see that nature, but there is competition there. But in last word, also, I'd say, look, even the guys that are developing the technologies that could be used in the food sector, perhaps instead of only focusing on a large-scale farm, somebody can think and say, okay, how do I develop a certain system that could be able to assist some relatively small or medium farm size in South Africa? Because that, you can even take it to the market in the continent, because most of the farmers are really small and medium. So you could be able to export your technologies and deal with that. And I think that given that nature of our agriculture, in their food system, some of the solutions need to really be focused on that and not only on the large-scale farming.
Right, that's Wandi Lesehlobo, who is an agricultural economist, talking about whether size matters in South African farming.
Let's quickly get into another discussion now as well. Public wage negotiations themselves have been concluded. But the question still remains, with ratings agencies just looming ahead. Friday, S&P will come out with its decision on South Africa's credit rating. Can we afford it? He's a senior lecturer at the Wits School of Economics and Business Science, and also an economist, Lumkile Mondi, joining us on the line. Mr. Mondi, thank you so much for your time. The big question then remains, can we afford this? We are under tight fiscal pressure here.
Very much so, Arabile. Good morning to you. And more importantly, is that, you know, our debt GDP ratio has risen tremendously, meaning that most of our budget goes towards consumption. Therefore, there's little money that we have in terms of putting into fixed investment. As Wandile was saying earlier, in the discussion that we just had, that, you know, the land reform program that we're talking about will require quite a lot of money from the state to support those the smallholder farmers or any form of black participation in that sector, which in fact is money that we're not going to have given the skew of our budget towards consumption and very little investment, and therefore inability of the state to service those.
But the discussions themselves have been very heated, have been very thorough as well. Was it a bit naive of South Africa, or were we a little bit too optimistic in hoping that we would be able to get salaries increasing at the same level as inflation just to appease the ratings agencies, for example? Were we just trying to appease them, or were we really trying to be diplomatic and helping ourselves in a way as well?
Rabile, if you know, we're all aware that in the period between 2005 and 2012, the civil service remuneration increased approximately by 145% over the period. And if you break it down, you find that part of it is due to inflation, and then also social improvement and remuneration, and a huge increase in civil service employment and promotions. So we never thought, I think what we see here is really a government that is under pressure, but more importantly, given that the election next year, is really trying to close ranks and appease the union stakeholder, particularly Nyahao, so that they'll be able to get the support that is required going forward. However, we expect that after the election, the government don't have to cut the public service at least by a third, while it consolidates the departments as well as the ministers that are already highly bloated. We need a much more smaller executive, but more important also, we need a public sector that is agile, effective, and addresses its responsibility as a public administration to the masses of our people who remain really having very poor services from the administration in the past 24 years.
Yeah, I think Ntlantlanene will have to really detail how he's going to get South Africa out of the mire on that one. Another issue that comes up as well this week, it's quite an important one. We have inflation coming out this week. We also have the interest rates decision by the South African Reserve Bank on Thursday. Your thoughts, a hold, a cut? A cut is probably, you know, one of the things that will make life so much easier, especially for homeowners, but there's a very high chance they'll keep things on hold.
Very much. We'll keep them on hold. I think, Arabile, given the settlements, you know, from the transport sector last week, and now the government, you know, all salaries are far above inflation. And therefore, you know, we're very worried about spending, but also with the dollar strengthening due to Trump policies and emerging markets weakening, including ours, there's going to be some important inflation, as we're going to see in the increase of petrol next month. So I think the Reserve Bank is going to act responsibly and keep them steady.
At the same time, S&P on Friday, do you think we keep our credit rating as is, or perhaps an upgrade to our outlook even?
No, keep it where it is, because there hasn't been much change at all. What we have a Ramaphosa and expectation, but, you know, This amphora is very fragile, given what we're seeing within the ANC itself, with all the clashes, Northwest, KZN, and now a looming also a clash after the election over the weekend in the Free State.
Sure.
So we remain really optimistic, but very cautious, and that's how they act. And until after the 29 election, when we know what policies the Ramaphosa government has and what it can deliver and reining in expenditure and really making South Africa very attractive for investors and for domestic business to invest, so that you can create those jobs that are required.
We wait for more information. Senior lecturer at the Wits School of Economics and Business Science and economist Lumkile Mondi joining us on the line there. Thank you so much for your time. Michael Avery joining us on the line. Classic Business happening later this afternoon, 5:30. Michael, what's happening?
Good morning, Arabile. Yeah, well, speaking of making your country attractive to investors, we're going to be having a look at Zimbabwe's long road to economic recovery. Recently, the CDC, which is a UK DFI, released $100 million of credit to help revive Zimbabwe's moribund economy. So I'll chat to Ben Leo. He's a former White House advisor. He's now CEO of Frame. We're going to talk about Zim's long road back to economic recovery. And Professor Raymond Parsons.
All right, we seem to have technical issues there with Michael Avery, but thank you to Graham Connor from Kerner Perspective joining us in studio. He's with us for the full hour, which was fantastic.
It was, yeah. Some great perspective as well from Kerner Perspective.
I see what you did there.
Hopefully we'll get Lindy Wazulu into the show tomorrow. We didn't, unfortunately, get through to her today, but it's been a really great and jam-packed show. Everything from land to public wages to, VTM, as they call it, to Sydney as well. We'll do this again tomorrow.
Goodbye.